This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Virginia Smith is here. She's written a book that looks at the scientific references in Robert Frost poetry. And Virginia Smith, welcome, and what is the name of your book?
Thank you, Grace. Yes, the title of my book is A Scientific Companion to Robert Frost.
And what's in the book?
Well, it's a reference book, and it really is a companion. The idea is that you would have your volume of Frost open in one hand, and you'd have my book in the other, and you could, as you went through a poem, if you ran across a scientific reference or a reference to nature or technology that you weren't familiar with, you would look it up in my book.
But you know, I just looked at your book, and I must say this. It doesn't have to be a companion to anything. It, in its own right, you can read that book, and it would be very fulfilling. And illustrations, too. I mean, this is a first of anything. I've never seen anything like it. And I'll tell them who you are.
Okay.
A nice chemistry professor like you. How did you get hooked onto poetry?
Well, as a way to relax. So this book really was born one afternoon while I was proctoring a biochemistry exam. It had been a hard semester, and on the way out of the house that morning, I grabbed a volume of Frost and was going to relax as my students took their exam. And as I was reading each poem, I would see scientific references. And I thought, wow, you know, he's talking about expansion of the universe. Or he's talking about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Oh.
Or this is a reference to a specific animal behavior or type
and
of tree.
And the rest of us would never know this. We would just think, what a lovely line length. Well, Virginia Smith is a doctor of chemistry?
Biochemistry.
Biochemistry and a professor of chemistry at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And she also is a researcher and has published over 20 scientific articles. And her interest in Robert Frost's use of scientific imagery and language has led to 3 publications and many speaking engagements, where she's really one of the Frost scholars, I believe, at our time. And serving as the president of the Robert Frost Society, had an A.B. in physics and chemistry from Mount Holyoke, served 5 years in the United States Air Force, and then earned her Ph.D. in biochemistry from Washington State University. Her husband's a writer, and they live in Annapolis. This only says a little bit of you. We won't talk about your wanting to translate Latin. We won't talk about your interest in the classics. We'll just show one little piece of the pie, and so very grateful. So America's iconic poet is interpreted by Virginia Smith. So I'm going to read a poem, and then I'm going to ask Virginia to just give her take on that poem. And we're going to start with a little poem from 1936, Evil Tendencies Cancel. Will the blight end the chestnut? The farmers rather guess not. It keeps smoldering at the roots and sending up new shoots till another parasite shall come to end the blight. That sounded almost ironic. Give us your feelings about that poem.
Well, this poem in, 6 lines, he encapsulates the whole tragedy of the chestnut blight.
In 6 lines.
In America. And he gives a factual description of what the trees looked like when the blight would strike them. So they smolder at the roots and send up new shoots. So the trees that were infected with this, with the chestnut blight, which arrived in America shortly after the turn of the 20th century, so early 1900s, there would be these large cankers, kind of split trunks. And the trees, the main tree would die. However, the roots stayed alive. And new shoots would keep coming up. And this was kind of a mystery. And the humans were pretty much powerless to stop it. So there may be one hope was that there will be another parasite that comes to stop it. And in fact, this is what happened.
And he was a great noticer of things. And though it doesn't sound like book knowledge to me, it sounds like he sees these things. And is that your belief?
I think combination. I think he was a great reader. He was very well informed on the science of his time. And as a farmer, he actually subscribed to, for example, like poultry journals and such. But he would read Scientific American.
Oh, that's interesting.
Popular Science. So he was, it was both. So he observed things and he could record them for us. But he also had a great desire to know what was going on.
So you saw a great degree of accuracy in your studies.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, I love this idea about another parasite coming to end the blight, because in fact, that is what happened.
And it is what happens in science.
That's right. And so in this case, it was, you know, the blight was actually a fungus, and the parasite was a virus that infected the fungus and eventually made it weaker. Just like viruses make us weaker, it made the fungus weaker.
Just adding that dimension is so important. So we're going to read another poem. It's called The Oven Bird, written in 1916, early on. There is a singer everyone has heard, loud, a midsummer and a midwoodbird, who makes the solid tree trunk sound again. He says that leaves are old, and that for flowers, midsummer is to spring as 1 to 10. He says the early petal fall is past, when pear and cherry bloom went down in showers, on sunny days a moment overcast. And comes that other fall, we name the fall. He says the highway dust is over all. The bird would cease and be as other birds, but that he knows in singing not to sing. The question that he frames in all but words is what to make of a diminished thing. That's so puzzling. He knows in singing not to sing. What do you make of it?
Well, that particular line, I can't claim any special insight onto that line, except perhaps the value of restraint.
Which is what I think is here, too.
Yes.
And so give us the scientific interpretation.
And so this is one of his kind of a classic description of nature. So Frost has a lot of poems where he's describing, and in this case, a natural ecosystem. So not just the bird, but the seasons of the year, the location where the bird lives. So the oven bird is known as a midwood bird. It does not live on the margins. You actually have to go in pretty deep to find it, and they are more often heard than seen. So I read somewhere that it takes about 450 hours of observation to actually ever see an oven bird, but they're very easily heard.
How many hours did it take you to find out about the oven bird?
I actually made great use of the Audubon Society website has, and the Cornell University Ornithology Lab.
Oh, yes,
lab.
They're right at the edge there.
Yeah, it's they have wonderful resources, and so I learned so much about
them. Did you
them.
Love doing this?
I did. I had a ball. I learned something new every day, and it was just a delight to write.
What a contribution to Frost and to American literature. Do you realize what a big contribution this is? When you're in the midst of it, you just think you're doing something. But then you find you're doing something. And Virginia Smith is our guest. She's a biochemist, but she is really a beautiful appreciator and promoter of poetry. So this is called A Trial Run, written in 1936. I said to myself, almost in prayer, it will start hair-raising currents of air when you give it the livid metal sap. It will make a homicidal roar. It will shake its cast stone reef of floor. It will gather speed till your nerves prepare to hear it wreck in a thunderclap. But stand your ground, as they say in war. It is cotterpinned. It is bedded true. Everything its parts can do has been thought out and accounted for. Your least touch sets it going round, and when to stop, it rests with you. Well, I knew it was mechanical, and I knew it rhymed, and I knew I loved something about this poem, but please elucidate what machinery this could be.
Okay, so I'm almost positive. He's describing a dynamo. So Robert Frost lived in Lawrence, Massachusetts. So after his father died and his mother brought the family back to Lawrence, Massachusetts, so they had been living in San Francisco, he moved to the Frost parents' home in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which was a mill town. And Frost himself worked in the mills as a young man. And one of the places he worked was what was called the dynamo room. And this is where you convert mechanical energy into electricity. And so that's what we're seeing here is that these there were these large, what they called dynamos, we might just call them generators today, which could actually take steam. So they would have boil water. That's the livid sap, metal sap. And so you boil water to make steam.
Was there a roar?
I'm sure it was very loud. He, in fact, talked about it in his letters, how loud it was and how would sit and read Shakespeare in the din of this.
He referred to a dynamo in his letters?
Yes, he does.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why he didn't in his poem. Don't you wonder? Because perhaps it meant a lot about industry in America at that time, and it could possibly cover more than one piece of phenomenon. Perhaps he was trying to make it more of an umbrella.
I think so. I think, you know, you might apply this to a train. He does write about, in other poems, the technology and how technology changed people. This is one of only, I think, four poems that actually talk about his time in the mills and with a lot of references to the machinery.
It's a good poem. It's a good poem. Okay, we're going to go to something called On Making Certain Anything Has Happened, and that's 1947, a little later. I could be worse employed than as watcher of the void, whose part should be to tell what star, if any, fell. Suppose some seed pearl sun should be the only one, yet still I must report some cluster one star short. I should justly hesitate to frighten church or state by announcing a star down from, say, the cross or crown. To make sure what star I missed, I should have to check on my list every star in sight. It might take me all night. Virginia Smith.
So the thing I associate with this poem is this: the knowledge that when his children were young, that he homeschooled the children, one thing he taught them was astronomy. He was a great amateur astronomer, and there's a lot of astronomical content. About 20% of his poems have some type of astronomy in them. And in fact, one of the things he did with his children, and this is what this poem reminds me of, is that he would assign each child a star. And each child had to be able to find that star in the sky and had to be able to, had to know all of the constellations and what the different star names were in those constellations. So this is very perhaps a description of maybe something he did with his children and with himself, of course, but expanded it.
There is a lightheartedness about this poem that I don't see in all the others, and almost a smile. To make sure what star I missed, I should have to check on my list every star in sight. It might take me all night. That's pretty wry, and I just... This is one of his lighter poems, I think.
Yes, and I think it was, but certainly astronomy was a lifelong habit for him. And, you know, it is one of my favorites, yeah.
As such a learned poet, an intellectual poet, and yet he had all the qualities of a great artist. So I think it's really interesting that science and art come together and that you as a biochemist also have a love of the classics, that things are not separated as once we thought.
Right.
That your inquiry goes everywhere, which is another program perhaps, but the fact that you as a child were always interested in science.
Yes.
But then as you grew, your interest was so vast that it was hard for you to funnel it, right?
Right. And at some point, you know, you have to. You have to, you know, if you're going to have a job or a profession, you channel it. And you, if you're lucky, you get to put a lot of energy into something you really love.
And why do you love biochemistry?
for me, part of its appeal for me is that it's one of those sciences at the borders of, you know, of chemistry and biology. So it takes chemical principles, applies them to living molecules, and helps us understand, you know, how plants live, how animals, how all life goes
humankind. On. Mm-hmm. Yes. And she teaches at the academy. I think they're really lucky to have her. And we're lucky to have Robert Frost. We're going to go on now. The next poem is called The Skeptic. And it also has to do with astronomy, I believe. So I'm going to read that one from 1947. And here it goes. Far star that tickles for me my sensitive plate and fries a couple of ebon atoms white, I don't believe I believe a thing you state. I put no faith in the seeming facts of light. I don't believe I believe you're the last in space. I don't believe you're anywhere near the last. I don't believe what makes you red in the face is after explosion going away so fast. The universe may or may not be very immense. As a matter of fact, there are times when I am apt to feel it close and tight against my sense, like a call in which I was born and am still wrapped. So we should say what a call is.
Yes, so a call is a thin membrane across the face that some children are born with, and there's nothing harmful about it, and it would be removed upon birth. And I guess famously in literature, David Copperfield was born with a call, and this was seen as a lucky thing.
It was. And in literature, they claim if a child was born with a call, that he had special sight. He had special vision and would be a seer.
And that's so ironic,
that's just
isn't it?
Superstition.
Because
yes.
You're born with something over your face, but you have. You
yes.
Know,
like, maybe that was a superstition that compensated for that. Talk to us about this poem and Eben Adams White. Is puzzling because ebon is black.
Right.
So, and fries a couple of ebon atoms white.
Yeah, so this is where the chemist in me comes out. And this is a process I know very well. So what he's describing is what we would call silver halide photography. And this is actually an experiment we do with our plebes at the Naval Academy, is they actually get to take photographs and develop them themselves. But here in this poem.
What does that teach them?
So it's a chemical process of transferring electrons. We call it oxidation and reduction. But they learned the chemistry behind photographic processes. And in fact, that's what Frost is describing here is actually spectrophotography. So the way that astronomers figured out could photograph stars was by exposing a large glass plate that had been coated with silver. So it'd be coated actually with silver in the ionic form, something like silver bromide. And in that form, it was black. It made a black coating. But then when an individual atom is struck by a photon, which is a particle of light, you might say, it would actually turn white. So it would turn into the silver atom.
How really important that is to know. The first two lines, far star that tickles for me my sensitive plate. And fries a couple of ebon atoms white. That is so clear, then. This is exactly what he means.
Yes, there's...
There's no doubt.
No, there's nothing ambiguous about this. And this is where some of my research came in, because I wanted to know, how did he know this? And in fact, his textbooks, he had within his library astronomy textbooks that actually talk about the process, devote... You know, an entire chapter to the process of spectrophotography and have photographs and diagrams of people using these instruments.
So that calls on him to say what he believes about the universe and that it makes him feel closer. He doesn't believe that it's expanding. He believes it's around him. Makes him feel very close to the universe.
Well, that's right. And in fact, he references the expansion of the universe. That's what he's talking about here, the after explosion going away so fast. So this is the effect of the Big Bang and the expansion of the universe. And astronomers observed this or determined the expansion of the universe by something called the red shift, which is, I think he also says, I don't believe what makes you red in the face. So this red shift is scientific evidence for the expansion of the universe in that the stars are all getting farther apart from each other. It's like dots. When you blow up a balloon with dots on it, they all get farther away from each other. And that's what's going on here. And so that's another scientific observation that he's referencing. So he's brought in the Big Bang. He's brought in spectrophotography. He's brought in the expansion of the universe, the astronomical
redshift.
In
one poem.
Yes.
Dr. Virginia Smith, the Academy is so lucky to have you. I would just love to sit in on the back of your class. Well, we're going to go on with an iconic poet. And the next poem is a tiny poem. And it's just, I just think it's a fun poem, 1928. It's called What 50 Said. When I was young, my teachers were the old. I gave up fire for form till I was cold. I suffered like a metal being cast. I went to school to age to learn the past. Now when I am old, my teachers are the young. What can't be molded must be cracked and sprung. I strain at lessons fit to start a suture. I got to school to youth to learn the future.
I love this poem for a couple of reasons. One is when he wrote it. So one interesting thing about Robert Frost was he didn't know his actual age until he was over 75 years old. And so I think that probably the year he wrote it, he thought he had turned 50. He was actually 51 by then. So I think that's kind of funny. He may have later as well. But as a chemist, I really love this line, the second line, I gave up fire for form till I was cold. Because what he's doing is very succinctly summarizing phase changes. So giving up fire for form, so we give up heat. As we give up our heat, we grow cold, but we simultaneously take on form. So if you think about steam filling a room, so a gas can fill any shape or volume. As it gets cooler, it will, for example, steam would turn to water, it will all settle at the bottom. And it can still make different shapes, but it can't fill any volume anymore. But once it's lost all of its heat, it turns to ice. And now it's highly structured, but it has no heat anymore. So it's given away its heat in exchange for structure. And that's what he's describing here. And he uses the analogy of a metal being cast. A scientist might talk about this as the process of entropy. You give up forms of motion. So as you become more ordered, or as you cool, you become more ordered, you become less disordered. And so this is an example I talk with my students about in terms of understanding what happens when materials change phases. They give up one thing for another.
Are you going to use this poem, these eight lines, next time to include in that lecture?
I usually do. I will. This is a poem that I enjoy using when I talk about phase changes, and I think Skeptic was one that I would use when talking with my students about expansion of the universe or light or the photography process.
How rich that is. You wonder how much trust he had in the reader to say so little about the processes. You know, I gave up fire for form till I was cold. He really believes we know as much as he does. And that is a great revelation because he had enormous trust that the reader was as intelligent as he was. And that is what the high tone and the elevation of his work. But it really helps us to find the inner life that you're giving us. We're going to end with another poem. It's called A Never Not Song. And then you'll help us with this. How do you pronounce that word?
Ooh, good.
Let's just say Yggdrasil.
Yeah, Yggdrasil, yeah.
A Never Not Song. There was never not, there was always thought. But when noticed first, it was fairly burst into having weight. It was in a state of atomic one. Matter was begun, and in fact complete, one and yet discrete, to conflict and pair, Everything was there, every single thing waiting was to bring, clear from a hydrogen all the way to man. It is all the tree it will ever be, bole and branch and root, cunningly minute. And this gist of all is so infra-small as to blind our eyes to its very guise, and so render nil the whole Yggdrasil out of coming in into having been. So the picture's caught, almost next to naught, but the force of thought. Well, I even see a scientific word there, atomic.
And hydrogen, right?
Yes.
And that's right. So it seems to me, as a chemist, I see something atomic one. I think of the periodic table. I think of the element which has periodic or is number one, which is hydrogen, of course. So that is, in chemistry, we assign numbers based on the number of protons in their nucleus, and that's hydrogen has one proton, and that was the first element that was formed.
And you believe he knew chemistry and read science?
I think, and I think this was certainly the and this. Probably would fall under the realm of astronomy, because certainly the most common element in the universe by far is hydrogen, and still is to that day. But all the elements since then had to come from hydrogen, and they were fused in other stars to make heavier elements. And so when he talks about, you know, having fairly burst, that's the Big Bang, when energy was turned into matter. That's one thing we learned from Einstein, right? The equivalence of energy and matter, E equals mc squared. So energy equals mass times the square of light, or the speed of light. And so that idea of an energy-mass equivalency was new, but that was a way to kind of create it, fairly burst into having weight. So it went straight from energy to mass. And certainly it was... That was hydrogen. That was the first element. And this idea of conflicting and pairing. So the way that heavier elements are made is by smaller ones
And it's
pairing.
Clear that he knew that.
Yes, yes, I think so. And especially, you know, he kind of spells it up out for us. Everything from hydrogen to man. And so certainly
Virginia
all the elements
Smith,
in our body.
Virginia Smith, I cannot tell you how I believe that Frost is honored by your work. You have actually shown a light on parts of it he would be delighted to have known. And you've made such a contribution. Please say the name of your book.
A Scientific Companion to Robert Frost.
And it's available now?
Yes, it is. Yes.
And this should be in every classroom, I believe. And certainly every place that teaches Frost will want this book. That was the voice of Virginia Smith. And this is The Poet and the Poem, from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Michael Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support from the Sinipet Fund. And our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.